Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behaviour nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Nikki Tudge. Nikki was born and raised in England, but now lives in Florida. Her background is in the corporate world and managing hotels, which has seen her travel the world and work in places such as Nigeria and South Africa. Whilst working in these roles, Nikki always found ways to help rehabilitate abandoned and abused animals and cooperated with organisations like Flora and Fauna International to protect endangered species from poaching, and then additionally helping those animals transition back into their natural habitats. Though her work with African native animals was fulfilling, Nikki's first love was always the family pet dog. And upon moving to the United States, Nikki started setting up projects to help spread the word about the benefits of force-free training, starting ventures such as The Dogsmith, a dog training and pet care business, and Dognostics Career College, an online educational forum for pet industry professionals. As choices of training methods increased, Nikki found availability of quick fix gimmicks popularized by TV grew, and misleading entertainment-based training techniques became generally accepted. Nikki found that it was more and more confusing for the pet owner to understand and differentiate the true foundation and efficacy of dog training and pet care methods and philosophies available. Because of this, Nikki saw a need for a new member forum where pet professionals committed to force-free training methods could gather to support each other and provide a resource to the pet-owning public. The Pet Professional Guild is Nikki's answer to this need. The Guild is dedicated to serving force-free pet professionals and the pet-owning public who want to be confident that the resources they choose adhere to a consistent training and business philosophy and ethic. So without further ado, it's my great pleasure to welcome one, Nikki Tudge, to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Nikki, how are you?
Hi, I'm not sure I'm ever patient, but I'll let you run with that.
Patiently, I see, peering over your shoulder.
I'm not described as being a particularly patient individual.
It was non-patiently waiting by. Shut up, Ryan. Stop talking about me.
Yeah, let's go for accuracy.
How's the puppy going? I can see you looking over your shoulder there.
Yeah, no, it's I'm really enjoying it, actually. It's lovely raising a puppy. I'm really enjoying it. But as I explained earlier, she's fed and watered and exercised, so I'm hoping that we'll have a nice stretch of time without any need for me to intervene.
Yeah, and if it does intervene, we're going to go on the fly and talk about how training happens in the moment. Not
on the go, real life training, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. Hey, let's dive straight into the first question. Nikki, could you please take the listeners back to where you first learned about positive reinforcement, animal training, force-free methods of managing animals' behaviour, and some of the first animals you ever started using it with?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. As a business leader, I'd been involved in lots and lots of business management, leadership programs, courses, etc., and do have a background in psychology. So positive reinforcement in the people environment was not new. And I think naturally, I've never been really a believer in punishing people. I'd much rather sway to the side of educating engaging and educating. And then in 2000, I, having spent, I think, 16 years overseas, where I met my husband in Nigeria, I moved. I was transferred to a job in Hawaii. And for the first time in my life, I thought, great, because I have a job and a home that's not going to be transient, because I've been transient for so many years, I decided to get a puppy. And actually, the puppy that we referenced a few minutes ago is this only the second puppy I've raised for me. I've obviously been involved in a lot of other puppy training. And did everything wrong, got the puppy, backyard, pet person, $50, bring it home in a cardboard box, no crate, no food, no equipment, no tools, to a husband in the background saying, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? This is not organized. This is not planned. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? And within about the first 4 weeks, this puppy was biting my ankles, ripping my clothes, leaving scars on my hands and fingers. And I frantically called a trainer that I found in a directory and said, I have an aggressive dog. You need to come and help me. And she drove all the way from Kona. We lived on the Kohala coast. And when she got there, she just literally laughed in my face and said, this is not an aggressive dog. This is a very typical puppy. And it's funny because her name is Tammy Goodrue, and she's actually a PPG member. Now we've reacquainted ourselves. And Tammy had been a marine trainer at the aquarium on Honolulu. So her only exposure to training had been through, obviously, operant respondent conditioning, but using reinforcements and a whistle. So when she moved into dog training, that was just the way she went. And I was asked in an interview several years ago, when did you transition from the more sort of aversive training? And it sort of stumped me because I never did transition because I was never exposed to it. And I think having come from the UK, pet dogs, and I believe this is accurate, pet dogs are still very much a larger part of our lives in terms of where we can take them and having access to public environments, into pubs and bars and restaurants. And as a child growing up, we never had pets because my brother was severely allergic, but I was always surrounded by friends that had pets and horses. So I was always a great animal lover, as were my parents. And I don't think it would ever have crossed my mind to have physically or verbally punished an animal. I just don't believe that would have ever been an option. So even when this puppy was, you know, chewing on all my plants and ripping my trousers and hanging off my arms, it never really crossed my mind that there was a punitive way of dealing with that. I think that's probably why I was stumped, because if you're not going to lash out sort of physically or verbally, how do you address the problem? And I'd been in my hotel. I was managing a Fairmont Hotel and Resorts property on the Big Island. And I'd been a hotel manager for many years and was actually just finishing my master's degree. I'd gone back to school to get my master's degree because I needed more intellectual enrichment. And that sort of coincided with getting a puppy and my exposure into dog training. And I took my puppy through puppy class, basic obedience, pet manners 1, pet manners 2, pet manners 3. Then wanted to go into agility, but there was no agility on the island. So I persuaded my husband to build the equipment. And before I knew it, the only real time that I was enjoying myself was on a Saturday when I was training my dog with Tammy and some of the colleagues. And it suddenly crossed my mind that maybe this is something that I should be spending more time doing. So my husband had actually gone out sailing on our sailing boat, and I was sitting in my office in the house writing my thesis for my master's degree. And I decided I'd go search on properties. I was going to leave my job and build a dog school. And when he got home that evening, I said, I found a house I want to buy in Florida. And he sort of looked at me. It wasn't unheard of for me to make very quick decisions like that. So he sort of looked at me and thought, oh God, here we go again. And I think within about 4 months, we'd moved and we're in Florida and we were opening our very first dog training school. So it was a really quick decision based on the fact that I just really enjoyed, I've always enjoyed teaching people, and suddenly I could teach people in an environment where there were also animals in the equation. And that for me was sort of the perfect environment to be working in. So that was how I first got exposed to our industry and positive reinforcement. That was a really long answer, wasn't it? It was longer than you probably expected.
Well, I'm going to unpack it even more. I'm really interested in, and something I'm becoming more and more interested in is people's backstories before they got into animal training. And your one is, as we talked about in the corporate world and managing hotels, you've got something that I know nothing about. It's just like the black belt of, what is it?
Six Sigma.
So people out there are like, oh, cool. Yeah. I'm like, I don't really know because I haven't been in that world. But I'm really curious about learning what people bring to our community from their previous experience. And obviously you've got one, a background you've got one, that being a background, and which is very different than the vast majority, if not all. I don't know anyone else with your background that shares similarities with yours. What have you brought forward into our community from your time working in hotels and in the corporate world?
I think one of the people sort of asked me how I became successful, and that's a really sort of loaded question, isn't it? Because success is determined by the person that's experiencing it. Because I look at some people that deem themselves successful, and I don't consider that a successful life because it's the output product of what they've got. But I think what most people generally mean by successful is, how did you manage to build a business, the Dogsmith Dognostics, and a couple of other ventures that we've been involved in, and sort of make money from it? And I think the salient answer to that is that I've always brought a corporate feel to it. So even when I owned my own dog training school, I put everything in standard operating procedures. I wrote manuals. I had handouts. It was very corporatized because that was the background I came from, particularly when I spent 3 years working with Six Sigma, because Six Sigma is a quality improvement program that sort of takes Kaizen and some of the other TQM programs one step further and actually looks at data, so that when you're making improvements, you're baselining everything with data, and then you provide dashboards to make sure that any intervention you do is actually having the desired effect. Well, doesn't this all sound like behavior modification? Baselining, looking at the intervention, determining if what you're doing is having the right effect, and then tracking the process. So the Dogsmith became very successful very quickly, and because of that, we wanted to duplicate it. And duplicating it was really simple. And we had a company that approached us about franchising, which we initially did for a year and then didn't like it because we didn't believe in the franchise model. And they sort of gave us this whole list of things that we'd have to do to franchise it, both legal requirements and system requirements. And I smiled and said, "We've already got that." And they sort of said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, we've already got all the manuals. We had like 14 manuals. We had puppy manuals and operant conditioning manuals and pet dog manuals and da-da-da-da manuals and everything, all the handouts, and everything was already done." Because I tend to be quite a linear, process-driven individual. So I think that's one thing that I brought to the table. And I think the other thing is that and I love talking to Veronica Patel from Dog Tech, because I think we're very aligned in many things. But the fact that you can make a living, you don't have to sacrifice the need to help animals with being able to make a good living in our industry. Profit's not a dirty word. I think if you've got good services and they're ethical and you price appropriately and you're transparent and you're delivering what you promise you're delivering, then it's fair to make a living. So I was never afraid to create a business model that had products that were competitive, that were in terms of pricing, but I believed had the edge in terms of the delivery of them and the ability to make a profit. And when we first started PPG, I'd been on the board of many nonprofits in the past, and I was having a conversation with someone about this only yesterday, and I actually had nightmares for having flashbacks, because so many nonprofits spend so much time looking for money, scraping around for money, that it actually deters them from their mission. And they end up having to compromise on their mission to take money off people to help sustain the business model. And when we first started PPG, I was determined that we were never going to be in that situation, even if it meant I put my own money into it, because I felt so strongly about the PPG mission and the guiding principles and what we wanted to create, that I didn't ever want to have to compromise those because we didn't have the funding to build the websites and the educational materials and get the products and services for our members. So I think because I brought also the ability to be able to manage a business and make sure it was profitable and sustainable, that I think that also was an important component that I brought to the table as well. And then the third thing is that for probably out of my 20 odd, almost 30, years of business experience, much of my success had always been with leadership, managing people, developing people. And I think that is a very underestimated skill that we have to have in our business, because dogs are not writing checks or processing credit card payments. It's the people. And I think often we overlook that because we're so geared towards the pet, and we can't reach the pets and be successful unless we can reach the people. That's our avenue through to success with the pets.
Love all of that. I need to figure out how to download your brain, but we'll talk about that later. SOPs and managing people, I'm learning all about now. So very interested in all of this stuff, and hopefully the people that listen to this podcast also derive value from that. I want to unpack I want to unpack you a little bit more, and understand how you operate. So even when you're in Nigeria and South Africa, you were, as you mentioned in your bio, working with organisations like Flora and Fauna and helping abandoned animals and animals in need. Can you take us back to that time and share a little bit of, you know, what you're thinking and feeling at that time, like when you were managing a hotel, like what was driving you to go out and put in this extra time and effort into to helping these animals and improve welfare and lives and et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. Well, I worked in Cairo for 3 years and was headhunted to take the job in Nigeria on. And the gentleman that was the operations director for Hilton at the time, I'd worked with in London many years before that. So as soon as his name flashed up, I thought, absolutely, Ashley Spencer, his name was. We actually lost him a few years ago, but fabulous, absolutely fabulous leader. Had a very successful career with Hilton International. So off I went with my two Persian cats and a first-class ticket from Cairo to Abuja. I actually flew into Lagos in Nigeria. And it was the first time I'd done an assignment overseas, and my father was really worried because at the time, Lagos was the murder capital of the world. And this is not an exaggeration, but driving from the airport to the hotel, you could see dead bodies by the side of the road. I mean, this was not an environment that my father was expecting a 30-year-old woman, single woman, to be going into. And I arrived at the hotel, which I shall not name because it was a competitor to the hotel I was working at the time, and they would not let me take my cats up to the guest room, so I had to sleep in the lobby because my flight was at 6 o'clock the following morning, and they wanted me to leave my two Persian cats in their crates in a back corridor, which I just obviously was not prepared to do. These were my kids. So the next morning, I got on my 35-minute flight from Lagos to Abuja, which is the very sort of, it was the very new and very artificial capital of Nigeria. It had been geographically positioned, so it was right in the middle. And that was done because of a new national assembly that was put in place. And in Nigeria, the north of Nigeria is sort of Hausa and Muslim, and the south is other tribes that were Christian. So to be fair and equitable to the people in Nigeria, they decided to put the capital geographically right in the middle. And there was nothing else there except for the city that was still being built. And when I got there, I arrived at this beautiful hotel that looks like an oasis in the middle of a desert. 700 guest rooms. The chefs had their own herb gardens. It was on 40 acres of land. Absolutely stunning hotel. And they had a children's zoo there that had chimpanzees and rhesus monkeys and alligators in it. And when I got there, I thought, oh my God, if the vice president or the president of Hilton International knew that their hotel was housing these animals that were illegal to be in captivity, it would be a public relations disaster. So having met my partner who became my husband, who was with the US Embassy, I had access to the American Peace Corps, and one of our Peace Corps friends was married to somebody in Flora and Fauna. So we called them and immediately assembled this rescue mission to get all these animals out of this kids' zoo. And one of them was actually a baby chimpanzee that some hunters had killed its mother. And we finally managed to get this chimpanzee down to the Cameroon border, where it went into a rehabilitation area. And for years later, I sort of followed the progress of this chimpanzee. So that was how it all started, because I'm not a big fan of zoos, to be honest with you. Having lived in Africa for many years, I do believe that there's a way for animals to live in free if with ecotourism and the right education. So I'm not a big fan of zoos. I certainly didn't want to manage a hotel that had a zoo that had animals in it that were living in sort of 5 feet cubicles. So that was the very start of it. And I just really enjoyed it. I can't tell you how I felt the day that we assembled a group of about 20 people that came there, that we had to sedate these crocodiles and tie them onto planks of wood to carry them into vans to get them out of the hotel property. And the feeling I had just by doing something that seemed so small, but yet I felt was so important, I don't think I'll ever lose that feeling. And I think there and then, I decided that wherever I was, whatever I could do, I would stand up and advocate for animals if they weren't able to do it for themselves. And I think that's one of the reasons why I felt so strongly about PPG, because I feel so strongly about being a voice for animals that need to be represented, particularly in scenarios where their, you know, emotional and physical needs are just being not just completely ignored, but potentially also being abused. So that was how that started. And when I moved to South Africa, I got involved with a private game lodge that work with the De Witt Foundation in helping to get the Cape hunting dogs and cheetahs off the endangered list, and spent a lot of time volunteering there as well. And again, I never really felt I had an option. I always felt that I had a privileged life, I had a great job, I had a fabulous husband, and I had some spare time, and just felt that I needed to be doing something with that time that was benefiting those that, you know, couldn't help themselves.
Never felt like you had an option. Well, we're grateful for those horrible situations. I mean, like, good things can come out of bad situations, I guess, if you know, that's the little things in your life that led you to be where you are today and create the PPG and be spreading the information that your organisations and the things you've started have.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because, you know, our lives are like a tapestry, because things happen to us as we grow and we evolve and we mature, and we don't really realize the significance of all those small events until we hit sort of 40, 50 and it all sort of weaves together, and we suddenly realize that we're a completely different person than we were 30 years before as a result of all these experiences. And, you know, and I went from being a sort of 17-hour-a-day corporate person that didn't really care about anything other than working to suddenly sitting back and saying, well, you know, there's a lot more to life than this. There's got to be, you know, there's a lot of enjoyment that can be pulled from other environments that also are beneficial to other people or other animals, rather than it just all be sort of go, go, go. And that's why backstories are so interesting, isn't it? Because it really is what makes the person that is in front of you.
Yeah, I love them. I call them our behavioural odysseys.
Yeah, that's perfect.
And yeah. I like the saying, small hinges that swing big doors. And maybe something we can take away from what you're sharing with us today is that if you're out there, if you're young or you're older or whatever stage of your odyssey or journey you're at, if you're doing something and you don't think that it's a huge thing, it could be a small hinge that's swinging in a big door.
It's like the expression, just, you know, small ripples that then become waves that then become sort of tidal surges, and, you know, there's a starting point for everything. And I think when we started PPG, the one expression that I find myself saying almost daily, if not weekly, and I say it every week now if I'm interfacing with somebody, is that this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. We can't expect for the results to be quick. We have to recognize that we're in for the long haul, to do it properly, to do it professionally, to do it without ostracizing people. It's an educational message that takes a lot of time.
So not sure if you're aware that ripples is like a buzzword in this podcast, and we're all about spreading ripples.
No, I did not. Yeah. Cool.
Perfect. This was meant to be. Yeah. Hey, let's just talk about something else you mentioned. Not to detract from where we are, because it's a beautiful thread, but just to move along as we work through the length of this podcast. Because one other thing I wanted to talk about there, which fascinates me, and I think we can, as the listeners of this podcast, learn from you and your journey, is that you said in Hawaii one day, and I saw your husband in the background, I believe they're doing something in the kitchen, and I kind of felt sorry for him at that time in his life when you came in and said, hey, we're moving to Florida, I found a house. and you made that decision. So talk us through how you did that. How do you talked about you needed more mental enrichment, so you went and did a master's degree. And you also mentioned there, you know, in Africa you had spare time. So I'm looking at you going, well, hang on, you're doing your master's, you're building this business, you're doing these projects with endangered species, and you're saying you have spare time. And so walk us through two things. How do you manage that? And and how do you, what is behind this ability to just get laser focus and then just go?
That's a really tough question. I think, I mean, I'll share some sort of deep-seated vulnerabilities with you. My biggest fear in life has always been failure, and that is not necessarily a good thing, because that often is sort of negatively reinforced motivation for working super, super hard and being super, super obsessed. And I certainly demonstrated that in my younger career, which is why I was the youngest manager in London when I was 24, and why I was probably, I think, the youngest person to be transferred out of London to the Sandy Lane Hotel in Barbados, which was the flagship of the company. I mean, you know, I worked really, really hard. I was obsessive. I remember a boss telling me years and years ago, you're going to die very lonely. You know, you're not going to have a social life. You're not going to end up with a husband, because all you ever do is work. So there was a lot, there was a pro to that, but there was also a lot of downsides from that. And I think some of that stems from my parents were both fairly competent, high-achieving individuals, and both were academically. And I rebelled at school. I mean, I left school at 16 with nothing. It wasn't until I hit sort of 20, 21, 22 that I finally thought, wow, I need to go back to school and get some education here. So I think my formative years were more about proving to my parents that I could make it without having a PhD, which my brother went on to do, as they had. So a lot of that was a tenacity in wanting to prove that I can sort of forge my own way through and that I'll be successful. And I, you know, as a result of that, I lost a lot of my youth because I didn't really have a youth because I was always working. I think as well, I think I have one of my mother's characteristics, which again is not necessarily a good characteristic, which is an absolute obsession with systems and organization, which can be a little bit neurotic. I mean, my husband walks around the house flicking pillars off sofas because our house has to be like a 5-star hotel, which was my work environment for years. And he knows that I cannot walk past it and leave it not centered, square or symmetrical, because that's just how my brain works. Is that a good thing? Absolutely not. And it's certainly not an easy thing to live with. So, and I'm also really good at time management. But I think the fundamental answer you're looking for here, Ran, is I don't have children. And I cannot imagine how many hours children and the financial drain they are on a family. I mean, and just not having that is immense in terms of the time that you have to be sort of more self-indulgent and do the things that you want to do. So that probably makes me somewhat very selfish. And the reason I chose not to have children is because I was very selfish with my time and didn't want to necessarily share it. So I think sort of a combination. But I think the biggest thing is this fear of failure, and that, and my husband, I quote my husband a lot, he's my best friend. And he always says to me that the one thing about me that fascinates him more than anything is that I just, even if I fail, I just brush myself off, get off the floor and just surge forwards. And I don't let anything stop me. And I think that's probably why I've been able to achieve what I've done. I think that's probably the most singular reason. I won't take no for an answer from anybody about anything ever. and again, that's not a good characteristic necessarily, but it is what it is.
Interesting that you can deal. So would you say that you deal with failure or you don't deal with failure?
I don't like it.
Deal with it. You get on with it.
Yeah. Well, I think what I tend to do is I say, well, if I can't go over it, under it or around it, I'll just charge straight through it. But I'm getting on the other side, however I'm going to do it. Whereas other people might be a bit less resilient. They'll sort of go try and go over it to the left, to the right, under and go, it's not going to work. I'll do something different. And I just sort of sit there and go, there's a way. There's always a way. There's always a way.
I think there's a ton of value that we can take from that. There's always a way. Do you think your approach to failure has changed since you were 24 managing a hotel?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, back then, it wasn't an option. Couldn't happen. Whereas now, I'm older. I'm a bit more laid back about things.
Never take away there being push pillows off couches if you're at an event with Nicky Tarch.
Yeah.
And shout out to the wonderful Veronica Bartel as well. We've had her on the show before and resonate with a lot of what she's saying.
Yeah, so they're nice great over at Dogbiz. I must remember their new business.
Oh, I nearly said Dotty. Yeah. So bring people up to speed now. Where can people go to find out more about you online and what you're doing?
Well, the Dogsmith's still around. We have a network of licensed dog trainers that we provide support for. That's dogsmith.com. Dognostics is sort of my... PPG is an obligation I have. And I say an obligation, I don't say that with animosity. It's an obligation because I just don't have any choice about doing it. It pulls me. It draws me. Because I'm very passionate about our industry having standard operating procedures and ethical standards so that we can, you know, deliver a high level of education and behavior modification programs to pet owners. So that's the platform for how I do that. Whereas Dognostics is my baby. I work that with Louise Stapleton-Frappell, who's a friend of mine, and we have a lot of fun doing it. It enables me to be very creative. So Dognostics Career Center as well. And I'm also really passionate about helping small business owners. I take it personally when a competent ethical pet care provider tells me that they can no longer be in business, they have to go find a job because they haven't been able to make it. Because we need these competent people out there providing services and options and resources to pet owners. So I'm very passionate, and so I can do that through Dognostics as well. I can help people, and I really enjoy doing that. And we give a lot away for free because we're very passionate about doing it. You know, I have friends that say, oh, I'm really struggling. It's like, okay, come on, get on the program. We'll help you. Because it really is about providing and enabling them to be successful as they determine success is, not how we determine it.
Mm. Moving forward then, we're going to talk about the PPG. And I know the listeners of this show, some of them are going to be involved in the PPG. Some of them might not have heard of the PPG before. Some of them might have heard of it, but aren't too familiar with what the PPG actually does. But if you want, we can shift gears and talk more about Dognostics. What would you like to touch on here?
I don't really look at them as being sort of separate. I think for me, they're almost like dimensions of my personality that I sort of get pulled into each of them, depending on. I mean, I love the fact that I have three or four different businesses because I feel I'm quite creative, and I like the fact that one day we can be rolling out a brand new program for our members. And Louise and I are actually working on a really nice product right now through Dognostics, which is what we believe are the 10 most important concepts that we need to be getting across to pet owners. Over the last few months, I've spoken to a lot of dog trainers and attended some dog classes, and all the focus is on skills. And I sort of look around me and people are there with these blank faces because it's all very well, you know, trying to explain someone the mechanics of doing something. But if they don't understand the backstory as to why they should be doing it like that and why it's important, then they don't really understand the concept. If they don't understand it, they're not going to embrace it. So I'll give you an example. One of them is nose, not a behavior. That's one of our concepts, that letting pet owners understand that, just because it's the default, isn't it? No. That, you know, let's teach the pet to do something in that scenario that you would rather they do rather than just be sort of that white noise, no. Another of our concepts is, yeah, you got it, so that pet owners understand the importance of using a marker, whether it's just a yes or a click, rather than good dog, good boy, good girl, which is probably the word they say 1,000 times during the course of the day. So it's not really salient or specific to the training session. So, and I'm kind of rambling now. But yeah, I don't mind, Ryan. I mean, PPG is probably takes up the most of my time because of the way it's grown. I don't think we ever really imagined it would grow as large as it has. When we started it, at the time, we owned an animal hospital and pet resort, and we just employed a brand new general manager. And the business wasn't very busy, so I decided PPG was formed, and we had these manual application forms. And I said to her, look, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sort of build into the scope of your job 20% of your time each day processing PPG application forms, thinking there'd be, you know, one or two a day. And I wandered down to the resort. It was separate buildings. My office was in the animal hospital, and I wandered down to the resort one day. And as I walked in through the reception desk, was this massive pile of paper on the front desk. And a little head came up from behind it. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, we got 150 applications. What am I supposed to do with them? And I was like, oh my God. And that was in the first week. So I don't think we realized that there were so many people that felt like I did, that I wanted to be part of an association that was scientific and was agreeable, that we're not judgmental. We don't stand in judgment. We're not antagonistic. We're not argumentative, but just an association that had guiding principles and sort of codes of conduct that I felt really comfortable with, that I could truly live by, and that would be, that a pet owner would feel safe going there knowing that anyone in this organization was not going to use prong, choke, or shock, or pain, force, or fear in an approach to managing, caring, or training their pet. And it bothered me on a personal level that the other associations I was a member of, if a client looked up my zip code, they may see me and underneath that a shock collar trainer, and underneath that, you know, another trainer. And I didn't want to be grouped like that. It was important for me that I wasn't grouped with trainers that didn't sort of have the same principles that I did. So that was why PPG was formed. And I don't think I realized, I wasn't I wasn't very prominent in the dog training community. I wasn't on all the Yahoo message groups. I was on Facebook, but I wasn't in groups. It was very much just me sort of chipping away at my corner of the world with Dogsmith. And I don't think I realized when I put my head up, where as I was expecting sort of whack-a-mole, these people just all started pouring out of the woodwork saying, "Hear, hear, we absolutely agree," and started joining. And it was an extremely reinforcing time to find that there were a lot of other people that felt the same way I did and that wanted to be part of an organization that could start to create those ripples and could start to question why as an industry we use tools that were designed to inflict pain or fear.
So it wasn't that you went out and kind of figured out that there was a gap in the market?
No, no, no. I mean, actually, I was in a large box store one day buying supplies for our resort, and a trainer in there actually was swinging a dog on a leash because it was barking at another dog. And I was absolutely horrified by it. And I went to talk to the manager, and he said, "Well, that's our corporate guidelines." He wasn't a dog trainer. And I said, "Well, actually, it's not your corporate guidelines, because I've seen your corporate training manuals, and there's absolutely no way they would endorse that." And he was completely oblivious. And I burst into tears and just ran out. And my husband pulled up to pick me up, and he's like, "Well," he thought I'd had a heart attack or something. He's like, "Oh my God, what's wrong?" And I said, I can't stand by and not do anything anymore. I need to do something. And he said, "Well, why don't you start an organization and start gathering like-minded people together and see what you can do?" His claim to fame is that he donated the first $100 to getting the business going because he opened a bank account and put $100 in it. That's his claim to fame, that he was the real founder of PPG.
And Nicky, small hinges that swing big doors,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So that's how it started. But I do want to just say here, Ram, because I think a lot of people make comments and I don't think they sort of really understand or read or learn about us, is that right from day one, the reason why we work so hard to write the guiding principles is because I am not an extreme person in anything I do, and extremism scares me. In anything, whether it's religion, politics, or dog training. And it was really important for me that we didn't create an organization that became that extreme voice, that it was going to be very rational, very educational, and very encompassing. And that's why we have a provisional membership level, so that anyone can join PPG. If you philosophically have decided that you would rather use these specific tools and this philosophy, but you don't really know how, join us as a provisional member, become involved, and we'll help you learn. And a lot of people think that we're closed off and we stand in judgment, and we don't. That provisional membership is there specifically to help engage and educate people. I think because people consider force-free a label, which of course it's a label. I mean, most words have a labeling effect. And people have quoted, "There's no such thing as force-free." Well, no, there isn't. But then you have to read our definition. We've taken the time to define it. And actually, to be able to define force-free, we've actually defined force, because they're the inverse, aren't they? And as our guiding principle says, even the US legal system cannot agree on the term force. So therefore, it's open to a definition that we've created. But what we have said in the context of our guiding principles as a general framework, that we determine physical force to mean, and I'm going to read it word for word, is any intentional or physical act against a pet that causes psychological or physical pain, harm, or damage. So by default, we don't allow choke, prong, and shock, because they're designed to inflict pain. That's how they work. Because we also get the question, well, what about gentle leaders? What about halters? Well, any piece of equipment can be used to harm a pet if somebody deems that's what they want to do with it. It's whether that's the approach or the physical act. So force-free basically means that we will not use shock, pain, choke, fear, or physical force. And as the inverse to that, we define force as being any action, physical or psychological, that is deemed to harm an animal.
And I guess you can go on and on and unpack and offer more definitions of all the words in the definitions.
Yeah.
Just go down a wormhole.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's that rabbit warren, isn't it, that we really you don't want to go down, because no one's ever going to agree. Which is why we spent so much time defining it, so people can read it and say, okay, that's their position on that.
And so you mentioned there that is, or maybe it's not, maybe you label this as something else, mm-hmm. One of your, or an incorporation, incorporate into one of your guiding principles. Can you expand on that for the listeners as an organisation, and not-for-profit organisation, right, the PPG?
Correct, yeah,
As an organisation, you have a set of guiding principles. What are these guiding principles?
Well, there's actually two pages of them, and they're available as a download on the website. But the first part of those guiding principles we call non-negotiables. And they're non-negotiables because our members are basically agreeing when they join that they will not use this equipment or this approach. And then the rest of our guiding principles are simply state that we will respect the freedom and dignity of others, we'll do no harm, we'll make sure our communications are professional, we'll always recognize the pet owner as responsible, we'll make sure the pet owner has informed consent, we'll use procedures and protocols and tools that are empirically based. So it's sort of they're more generic. So our guiding principles are divided between our section one, which is our non-negotiables, and our section two, which is our professional ethics, and then collectively our vision, mission, and values, which is obviously where we would like to see our industry go. I mean, our vision is that we envision a world where people and pets can live together to their mutual benefit, free from physical and mental pain, stress, and fear, as valued family members. I mean, that's our vision. That's where we would like this to be. And if, you know, and I often tell people, if, well, you know, I would love to be able to close PPG. I would love to be able to walk away from PPG and say we no longer need it. It is now the standard in the industry that everybody is agreeing to a set of ethics and a set of procedures and protocols and standard operating procedures. So why do we need a separate association to represent those individuals that are doing that? Because the industry at large is sort of policing its own members through proper credentialing and proper oversight.
And so this kind of conversation kind of leads into the next thing that you and I discussed talking about, and that was your shock-free coalition, mm-hmm. which falls under your guiding principles about what PPG is all about. And you said that these businesses are an extension of your character. Mm-hmm. So I can say what you're all about. Can you tell us about the shock-free coalition, what it is, and...
Yeah. Well, we always had a PPG advocacy division, and we were sort of advocating for education for, you know, the guiding principles for the organization. And 2 or 3 years ago, we thought, you know, we really need to take a stronger stance on shock, and we need to sort of, you know, laser point into what we believe is the most problematic issue. And I'm not in any stretch of the imagination saying there are not other fish to fry, but this is by far the largest, particularly in the US. The way that shock collars are used here and underground fencing. So we rolled out the Shock Free Coalition a year ago, which basically said, look, if you agree with us, if you agree that pets have an intrinsic right to be treated humanely and that you would like to see shock collars not available for training and care of pets, then sign our pledge. And that morphed into a bigger website and a bigger message. So we actually built a separate website for it. And then about 8 months ago, I was approached. Here's that small hinges that you speak to, Ryan. A year ago, I decided that we needed to have some very effective legal advice for the organizations, that we could truly start to look at legislation and move some of our positions forwards. And obviously, we're talking about a huge amount of money. So I spoke to my husband and said, I'm going to go back to law school. I'm going to go get a law degree, and then I'll have the expertise to do it. We can do it in-house. So I went through the application process and was accepted into law school. Paid the first year, got all my information going, was sort of shaking my head. My husband wasn't really happy about it because he said, look, you know, I sat through your master's degree. I sat through everything else. We're at an age now where we should be enjoying ourselves. And this is going to be another 10 or 15 hours a week of studying. And then I spoke to Dr. Karen Overall about it, and he spoke to a couple of people about it to sort of, you know, self-check. Am I being really ridiculous here? I spoke to Lynn Honickman about it and PPG Steering Committee, and I thought, you know, this is something I don't have a choice. I have to do this. And I've always been intrigued by the law, by particularly business law. 2 months after that, I get a phone call from a lawyer from one of the largest law companies in the US, and they'd heard about our mission, and they were offering us a pro bono contract to work with us on this. And they were also going to try and bring a very heavy-hitting, top-notch public relations company in from Los Angeles. And about 3 months after that, we signed the pro bono account with them. And I'm not mentioning their name because we decided strategically it was best not to do that until we first get some traction. So we now have a pro bono account with one of the largest law companies in the US. I have offices all over the US, and I've had a few conversations with them where we've had lawyers on the call from New York, from DC to LA to Chicago, passionate lawyers that are helping us work on this. And at that point, I thought, you know what? Thank you so much, because now I don't have to fulfill my need to go back to law school. So I very gracefully stepped away from it. At the same time, I'm going, oh, I've just got 15 hours a week back. Wonderful. So we've now got a group of lawyers working on approaches in terms of, do we approach this from a animal cruelty perspective? And I think the overriding decision was that there isn't a one size fits all because of the way the US is set up. This is not going to be something that's looked at from a federal, a legal standpoint federally. It's going to be something that each individual state has their own laws. So we're now doing research into all the individual states to determine what laws are currently on the books so that we can tailor an approach in each area to start moving some local legislation. So that's where we're at with the Shock Free Coalition. So if you're listening and you haven't signed the pledge, please go and sign the pledge and get involved.
And we'll link to the pledge on the podcast write-up as well. I'm just going to make a note of that to make sure I do that. And if you're a lawyer listening out there and you live somewhere other than the US and shock collars are still legal in your country, because I know that there's movements happening and every country is different, as you mentioned, with the legislation and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm always curious about other people's approaches to this and what can we take away from what you just offered? If we're not in the US, if we're in New Zealand or Australia or, you know, a host of other countries around the world, obviously.
Yeah.
What can we take away from your journey so far? What can listeners take away?
Well, first of all, our Shock Free Coalition has chapters in the UK, in Scotland, in Gibraltar. So if you want to be a regional coordinator in New Zealand or Australia or anywhere else, just fill out the form. We'll happily get you on board and get you up and running. Because I believe very strongly that this is something that has to be driven locally, because most politicians are not interested in anything like this unless their local constituents are putting pressure on them. So I think it's going to be one of those situations where we have to have local pressure and then state pressure through state legislators. I think with everything that PPG is trying to do, I think the most important aspect of it all is just education, is that there is a set of the population that's not open to even listening or having, you know, courteous dialogue because they're very entrenched in their ideas. And then there is a huge swath of people, that the people we're trying to reach, that just don't know any better. And, you know, everybody quotes Dr. Susan Friedman, you know, when you know better, you do better. And I generally believe that most pet owners, when they know better, do better, because most pet owners do not bring pets into their home with the mission of harming them. I mean, they're valued members of the family. So everything is about approach, it's about delivery of message, it's about messaging, it's about engaging, it's about being open to recognizing that you just sow seeds today that will hopefully prosper tomorrow, next month, next year. And that if you're one of those people that is out there on Facebook, you know, keyboard warriors, standing in judgment, being hateful, you're actually damaging our mission. You're not helping our mission at all. As the leader of this organization, as the current leader of this organization, I challenge anyone to find anything that I have ever written or said that is in any way antagonistic, confrontational, argumentative, derogatory, judgmental. That's just not who we are as an organization. So I'm happy for people that feel strongly about it enough to throw stones at the glass windows, but we're not going to throw them back. I mean, that's just not how we're ever going to approach it. And it was very important to me when we first set up PPG, when I first recruited our board of directors and our steering committee, that everybody truly understood that if that's the kind of organization you want to be part of, then you need to go and start your own, because that's just not who we are. It's not who I am. It's not an organization that I would want to be a part of.
I'm glad you literally answered the or started to talk about the topic I was going to ask you about, and that is keyboard warriors. And so we're talking about what not to do. Mm-hmm. I might, you know, obviously keyboard warrior is a label, and yeah, I might not place it upon myself.
Yeah.
But I'm a listener of this podcast, and I see things on social media, and I get angry. Mm-hmm. You know, I see people mm-hmm. promoting. An example recently, someone shared with me was promoting the use of citronella collars, mm-hmm. right? And they wanted to reply to this message, and So we've talked about what not to do. So don't be judgmental. Don't do this. Don't do that. What advice can you give to people that don't have that skill set necessarily? They see this stuff, they get angry, and they want to help.
Well, I always say to myself, well, first of all, I don't always respond instantaneously because, you know, we all have conditioned emotional responses. I mean, that's, you know, it's the fabric of who we are. I think number one is to always be factual. And if you're, and I always try, I don't always try, I cite, I mean, you have to cite, you have to defer to what I call that sort of white coat expert, the doctors, the PhDs. You know, I could argue that I have an extensive background in psychology and I'm self-read and self-researched and I know a lot. But I'm not a PhD in psychology. I'm not a behaviorist. So when I say something and Dr. Karen Overall says something, she carries a lot more weight. And I always laugh about this with Karen at some of our summits. It's like, you got to use Karen's name. You've got to use a name. You've got to use a quote. You've got to use her work. You've got to cite all her research. You've got to be factual. You've got to ask questions. I think we have to do a lot more inquiry to try and understand why people have chosen to use the tool they're using. Because if we don't inquire and dig a bit deeper, then we're not able to truly answer them and provide education. I think we offer up solutions that are feasible for them, that are affordable for them, and there are lots of them. And I think we do it very politely. And one of the things that I explain to our steering committee members and anybody who represents PPG on committees is that when I'm answering somebody on Facebook, I'm not just thinking about that person that I'm responding to. I'm thinking about that virtual audience that is above in the cloud looking down, watching what I'm typing. Because I might not, my polite, well-constructed response might not impact that one person that's very entrenched in their thoughts. But what about the 400 people that are reading that post later that sort of will hover over my comment and go, that's a good idea. I'm going to go try that. And I think sometimes we don't take enough time to think about how are we being perceived? Are we being perceived as credible, as rational, as reasonable when we start sort of, you know, going at it really quickly? And I there's a lot of people I know that are very articulate and highly professional and lovely people, and I watch them on social media and I just think, you're not doing yourself any, you're doing a disservice to yourself. You really are. Because if you were sitting face to face talking to somebody, the approach would be completely different. So I think for me, it's about recognizing that you're not talking to an audience of one when you're replying to somebody on Facebook or LinkedIn or wherever you are, that there are hundreds, potentially thousands of people that are hovering, lurking, reading and watching, and you have an ideal opportunity in the here and now to impact their buying decision or their decision making about this piece of equipment or about this particular philosophy. So think about that, because the minute that you start to be harsh, that entire potential audience just switches off and moves on. And what a huge loss of opportunity to educate additional people.
Yeah, I'm very passionate about this at the moment and kind of just want to keep talking about it. But yeah. let's push on, because as always, I have more questions than we have time to answer. Let's talk about your books, though, and just because of time, let's focus on a book. And I'm going to focus on this one, Nikki, not because of my own interest, but because it's something that I see talked about and conversations started about in my private members-only Animal Training Academy Facebook page, and that is about how we can be as successful as we possibly can with our clients. So you've got a book called People Training Skills for Pet Professionals, Your Essential Guide to Engaging, Education, and Empowering Your Human Clients. I like how you start dancing when I read out the title of your book. can you offer, once again, just conscious of the time, quick fire tips, maybe like three tips for the audience of this podcast that you can offer them to help them be engaging, educational, and empowering to their human clients?
Okay. All right. The first thing is what I call the psychological contract. I love the psychological contract. It's where we get very heavily entrenched in, okay, sign this contract, this details our refund policies, blah, blah, blah. I like to have all the really important discussions up front, because that then becomes your reference point throughout the relationship with your client. So that conversation looks like, let's really understand what your role is versus what my role is. Let's understand what your obligations are versus my obligations. Let's understand that I will support you in your endeavors, but I also would like you to support me in my endeavors to teach you. Because what tends to happen is we don't sort of baseline expectations with our clients. And then 2 weeks into it, and I hear this through my business consulting that I do through Dognostics, but my client doesn't do their homework, but they arrive to meetings late on time, but they're not doing what they said. And you're holding someone to an expectation that you've never outlined for them or got shared meaning and agreement about. So for me, that psychological contract comes in the first appointment where you agree to move forward and you say, okay, let's talk about the rules of the road. Let's talk about how we are going to work together as a partnership, because this is a team effort. So that when things do fall apart, if they fall apart, you can say, look, you know, do you have a few minutes? Because I'd like to talk to you about the fact that homework doesn't seem to be getting accomplished. Remember when we first met, we discussed that this was going to be the expectation, blah, blah, blah. You have a point of reference. It makes it much easier to approach sometimes those difficult conversations. And it makes it easier to approach them in a collaborative way rather than going in and blaming the client or being punitive because they haven't done what they've said they're going to do. So I think that's really important. I don't think as an industry we do a particularly good job at that. I think the other thing that I hear all the time, which I speak to in the book, is that it's almost like we're afraid to expect our clients to recognize that there's going to be 6, 8, 12 lessons here. So we tend to rush into just giving everything in 2 lessons. We throw everything at them, including the kitchen sink, our flyers, our handouts, our psychology books, our nomenclature, this is what you're going to do. And we wonder why they don't come back. And we do it because we either have to prove to them very quickly that we are competent and know what we're doing, or we feel for the sake of the pet, they're not going to want to invest in the long term. So we've got to like shove it all at them at the front end. And I think we need to do much better at planning out our lessons. And third, within our lessons, planning out our sessions, something I speak to a lot and I'm really passionate about, because in a lesson, we may be touching on 2 or 3 of my 10 concepts in terms of important knowledge they need to know that is then going to be the foundation to the practical training we're going to take them through. And having observed a lot of trainers doing lessons, it tends to just be a lot of blah, blah, blah. And there's no differential between now we're going to talk about the name game. Why are we doing this? Because A, B, and C, making it salient. Adults need to know why. If they don't understand why, they do not buy in. They don't buy in blindly. Then we explain to them what we're going to be covering to what degree. And then we show them and we have them participate so that they go through the learning cycle so that they conceptualize it, they observe it, and then we teach them the physical mechanics of how to do it. And in one lesson, we may do 2 or 3 sessions. We might work on how to stuff a Kong. We might work on the name game. We might work on the first component of teaching a loose leash walk, just standing nicely on a leash. And if we don't have an open and close to each of those 3 sessions within that lesson, when we leave, we have a client who's literally going, what have I just covered? And then we throw homework at them and we come back a week later and we say, why haven't you done your homework? Well, they probably haven't done it because A, they didn't understand it. B, you didn't supervise that they could actually demonstrate they could do the homework competently, which means as soon as they start it, they feel like an idiot and they stop. Or we're asking them to do far too much and we're putting far too much onto them, where I believe homework should be building the skills their pet needs that are fully integrated into the time they interact with their pet already, not additional time. We can't expect pet owners to do 30 minutes of homework every night with their dog. They just don't have the time. But what we can do is generalize concepts by saying, we've worked on sit. We've now got the dog sitting on cue to the word sit for 10 seconds with you 3 feet away. How can you integrate that into the time that you already spend with your pet? Feeding, opening a door, petting. They will come up with these answers, which means you've got buy-in. They're going to actually do it. They're going to be successful. You're going to be successful. The pet's going to be successful. So I think that's probably the top 3.
So 2 and 3 were planning. And the first one is a psychological contract. And you said, have an open
planning
quote.
And execution of how we conduct our lessons and how we allocate homework to our clients, making sure that what we're asking them to do, we've actually observed them doing, so we know that they can do it properly and that they have the time and it's feasible and it fits in with their lifestyle.
And so this information is available in his book, and also there's a similar products from Dognostics, is there, to help people with this stuff?
Well, it's part of one of our programs, but no, at the moment, no, it's not. We are developing our 10 concepts, which is a part of that, but we're constantly, one thing I love about Dognostics is there's just no end to the services that we can help provide for people so that they get better at doing what they do.
And so the best place for people to go to buy this book and find out more?
They can get it on Amazon. They can buy it from Dognostics. a lot of the components of actually breaking down skills and teaching skills, they can also find in another book I've got called, I can't remember the name. It's a coaching book that was actually written for people training skills in businesses.
Is it called Training Big for Small Businesses? Maximize your business performance by becoming your own training department. Effectively teach new skills, transfer well-trained staff with a winning attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it is. It's the same. That's the process for teaching people. And really quickly, because I know we don't have a lot of time, but very early on in my career, I was sent to a hotel to work in Guyana in South America. And I went there to do some management training. And I held a 5-day management workshop from Monday to Friday. And then on the Monday, everybody came back. And I couldn't believe that the retention was really bad. I was like, oh my God, I must be awful. Nobody can remember anything. And I was very young, not as experienced as I am now. And a friend of mine said to me, what's the education level of the people you're training? And I said, well, many of them didn't even go to high school. And they said, well, that's probably half of the problem, that you're dealing with adults that don't necessarily understand how to learn, how to store information, and then how best to recall it and apply it. So I had to then go on a journey of looking at, if I'm working in third world countries and I'm going in expecting, I was actually going in to develop trainers to train the labor force. You have to take that into consideration. So not only did it affect my approach in terms of training managers to train employees, but we had to take into consideration, and here's just a really quick example. We had a really bad storm. It was hurricane season. And we had several of the employees that couldn't get home because of the weather. So we asked them to stay in the hotel. And the next morning, the general manager said, well, I don't think anyone stayed in the hotels because the housekeeper had reported that none of the beds had been used. And I thought, well, how can that be? And we approached the staff and they had stayed in the hotel, but they hadn't used the beds because at home they didn't have beds. And yet these are staff that we're trying to train to provide accommodation services to 5-star hotel guests. So how about we actually let them experience and conceptualize what we're asking them to provide for other people? And it made a huge difference in their ability then to learn how to do specific tasks and skills and do them repeatedly to a high standard. Does that make sense? It was something I'd never even thought about before, that here we are trying to teach somebody how to set a dining room table to the right standard, but at home they didn't use knives and forks. And then we get cross because they don't deliver the service correctly. I mean, how unfair is that? So the first thing we did is initiate a program where every member of staff came and stayed in the hotel for 2 or 3 days and experienced the restaurants and the rooms and used the showers. And because only when they'd actually experienced it themselves could they conceptualize what we were then asking them to do to provide that same service for other people. And I think it's the same in our dog training sometimes. I think we forget how difficult it was for us to learn how to do something. So when we're teaching people, we skip the foundation because we just have an assumption that they already know that. And then we wonder why they don't grasp concepts, because we've started the teaching at level 5 when we should have been teaching it at level 1, because we've lost touch with what people know and what they don't know.
I'm going to try and build on this, and potentially we're going off on a tangent. I don't have much time left in this podcast, I say, and then I ask questions like this one. But some of my members, a repeated conversation I see from a significant number of members say that they are loving all of the online learning that's happening in 2018. For example, they might be working with aggressive dogs or separation anxiety, et cetera, et cetera. Some of those more challenging ones, especially. Yeah. And they read it and they do a course and they learn it and they say, great. Now, how the heck do I apply that? So what advice can you give to people that are out there that don't have anyone in their immediate vicinity that they can go and learn how to lie in a bed with or set a table with knives and forks? They don't have anyone they can watch. They don't have anyone that can observe them working with aggressive dogs and separation anxiety. What advice can you give to these people? Because I know that it's a need that people are wanting that they're not finding. Mm.
Yeah, and it's actually the reason why we started Dognostics, because I got a couple of diplomas through a college and it was all academic. And I just felt that given that probably I would hate to sort of just pull a percentage out of the air because it wouldn't be accurate, but how much of our time is actually teaching people mechanics? I mean, Bob Bailey, as an example, I mean, a big, huge believer that most of what we're doing is mechanical. So we are teaching people a mechanical skill. The approach to that is very different than lecturing to somebody or trying to impart knowledge. And the only way you can do that is by actually breaking down the skill, showing them what it looks like, breaking it down, like dog training, breaking it it down, and then allowing them to practice and experiment with the mechanical skills. And then they go through their own process of tinkering where they get it right. So with Dognostics, when we launched our dog training program, it was absolutely a huge proportion of it's got to be hands-on and built and broken down into components where people could tinker and develop their mechanics and get that right. So yeah, it's a difficult question. And you can experientially learn by observing somebody on a video. If that person is demonstrating in a very strategic manner and it's broken down and there's an explanation, because think about this, when a pet dog owner, how often do we shove a clicker in their hand, put a bunch of treats in their hand and say, all right, click treat, go on, okay, click treat, mark, click treat. But we're not understanding that even the concept of a clicker is not easy for some people to mechanically navigate. You know, some people just can't even click at the right time because that's not how they're designed. Understanding at the same time as doing that is the place and position of reinforcement, looking at the dog to make sure the dog's comfortable, the timing of the click, how you stand, how your posture is. There is so much more to our industry than I think we often give ourselves credit for in training animals. But we expect a client within 20 minutes to be teaching, to be getting all that right. We lump it all. We preach we don't lump with our pets, but we do with our clients. So I think you can learn from observing people on a video if it's the right instructional video you're watching. I think you can also learn by videoing yourself and asking someone to critique it if you break it down into small components. And it's a shame because I think there is a need for a real sort of mentoring program in our industry. I think sometimes it's very difficult, and I know how I struggled when I first started. You know, I felt like a bit of a charlatan when I started charging clients because you sort of question, should I even be doing this? Have I got the experience? But you've got credentials behind your name, but how much actual mechanical hands-on skill do you have, both with animals and with people? So I think there's lots of ways you can get experiential in terms of observing. And I think sometimes just understanding the actual learning process and being able to analyze what it is you need to learn in its true components can help as well, because then you can split your own learning down. So maybe you split down your learning of observing reactive dogs. Maybe you split your learning down in the best way to handle them on a leash. Maybe you split your learning down to actually understanding the protocol you're going to be using, and you get competent at them individually before you put them all together with a real dog, as opposed to just going out and doing a theory course and then just going and grabbing a reactive dog and off you go when you haven't yet become. And I approached pet owners the same way. Let's go back to my concept. What is a marker? What is a tools and equipment? What is no isn't a behavior? What is how are we going to do this? What, you know, and then you, as they sort of become competent at the clicker, at the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, then you put it all together. And they not only have the knowledge they need, but now they've got the mechanical skills. And at that point, you go, my job here is done. Because now you've got a pet owner that says, oh, if I want to add a dimension to this behavior, this is the recipe I'm going to use, using the train, test, train system, rather than just teaching them parrot fashion, but not actually teaching them concepts behind the recipe.
In the words of Teresa McEwen, the aim of this podcast is to get people passion talking. And I think we just accomplished that. I think we've unpacked you, Nikki Tudge, and we've found the area that is really motivating and your passion lies in at the moment, and that's helping people get this stuff right. Am I correct here?
Absolutely.
I'm seeing that in your body language now.
Absolutely. And it upsets me and it drives me, because there are so many fabulous dog trainers out there and they don't have that. They're lacking the ability to take those fabulous skills they have and that great knowledge and that passion and deliver it in a vehicle that pet owners can grab and run with. And then people say force-free training doesn't work. And it does. We know it does.
And if you're like me, you want this conversation to keep going. But we're going to start to wind it up. Hey, Nikki, let's just run through. We've got two more questions that I'd like to ask all of our guests. And we'll just do a quick story. I'm a massive fan of learning through storytelling. It's one of my favorite ways to learn. And I love guests telling stories. Can you share just one quick story with everyone listening? You've already shared some great ones today. But one more that has really taught you something that might have been a small hinge that swung a big door, but really taught you something throughout your career.
Yeah, I think this story is probably the reason why when Joe Nora and Jennifer Schreier decided to step away from Dog Gone Safe, why I stepped forward to take on the role of being president. Dog Gone Safe is a dog bite prevention nonprofit, And the story goes like this. I was dealing with a dog training client who happens to be a professor of psychology at a university. And I thought, brilliant, professor of psychology, this is great. Half the work's already done, isn't it? This is someone that is, he was actually the department head of the psychology department. And the first lesson, I just struggled so much by the way his mannerisms towards his dog and the way he handled the situation. And I couldn't understand it because he obviously got the concepts of positive reinforcement and aversives. And he was absolutely convinced that what he was doing was reinforcing his dog. And then I sort of went home and I one thing I try to do every day without a failure is when I, at the end of my day, I learned this from Stephen Covey lecture I went to back in 1986 or something, is at the end of the day, when I got home from work, I would stop in my car, open up my time planner and make sure that I'd finished my day so that when I closed it and went into my home, I was free of worries of have I missed it, blah, blah, blah. And part of that little ritual that I did that I still do to this day now is, sorry, I've got a little puppy barking in the background, it's okay, is
I can see your husband running to the rescue. So.
is thinking about what I've done today that I could have done better. Have I said something that could have been misconstrued that maybe might have offended someone? Is there something I need to do to repair that? And I sort of go through that as a mental washing at the end of the day. And I try to be really insightful. I try to be insightful about myself and my own actions. So I went home that night and I thought, what's missing here? And then I realized he doesn't understand canine communication and social behavior. So everything that he's kind of robotically applying to the approach to his dog is in the vacuum. There's sort of a behavior myopia as to what his dog is telling him. And that expression, behavior myopia, is an expression that one of my colleagues, Angelica Steinker, termed. And I actually take it one step further by saying that it's sort of the social behavior and communication of dogs myopia, that we see through what they're telling us. So we may be working with a dog and assuming that we are in this quadrant applying this protocol, but in fact we're not, because we have to look at the animal in front of us and say, how is the animal perceiving or feeling about what we're doing? So the next lesson, a week later, I went back rejuvenated, and we spent the first 30 minutes of the lesson talking about how dogs communicate, signs of stress. And I just saw this huge light bulb go off. It was like, oh my God. And he actually was very insightful. And he said, wow, so I've actually been punishing my dog. And I was like, yeah. And we moved forwards and we were highly successful. So for me, that story has always made me very interested in canine communication, social behavior, and the fact that, I'm not sure if I should say this or not, but I'm going to say it. You can edit it out. Everybody thinks they're the best lover, the best driver, and the best dog owner, but most people are crappy lovers, they're crappy at driving, and they don't understand what their dogs are telling them. So I think we need to get much, much better, the general population, at really understanding our dogs' communication systems. And I have friends that have had pets for 20 or 30 years and will argue with me about stress signs in a dog because they know better. Because everybody knows pet dogs.
So you're saying, well, firstly, earlier you identified you had imposter syndrome back in the day. Mm-hmm. But now you're saying that everyone's a Donnie Kruger.
Who's Donnie Kruger?
Is it Donnie Kruger? It's the opposite of imposter syndrome. Thank you to Stephanie Edlin for teaching me this. But it's when people think their skill levels are up here, but their skill levels are actually down there.
There's a word for it, and I can't remember the. Yeah, but I think in general, pet dog owners have had pets their entire lives. I've never really stopped to think about all those communication signals. I mean, our pets are communicating to us all the time. And I think we just need to be a bit more in tune with what they're saying. I think as behavior professionals, we get it wrong as well sometimes, because we go into a training session, this is our goal, this is what we want to do, this is how we're going to do it. And I think sometimes we look at ourselves on video and go, oh, wow, the dog really isn't very comfortable there. Maybe a change of posture would have made it better for them, or higher rate of reinforcement, or maybe lowering my criteria, because we become myopic to what's actually in front of us because we're sort of being goal-driven. And I think pet dog owners, I think often, and that's why Dog Gone Safe is a great resource, because there's massive resources there about canine communication to try to help make it safer for dogs and safer for people for us to coexist with them.
Beautiful. Hopefully that's resonating with a lot of you out there listening to it, and I'm fairly confident that it is. Let's move on to our last little segment before we wrap up. Nikki, you took us way back to when you were 24 and being the youngest manager of a Hilton hotel in London. Was it London?
Yeah.
Now take us forward. We want to push forward now into the next 5 to 10 years. And you've potentially already answered this question if we filtered back through your offerings in this podcast. But build on the stuff you've already given us so far. What do you really want to see transpire over the next decade?
Okay. I would like to see a umbrella above our industry that guides what we do and how we do it in terms of standard operating procedures, equipment, tools, ethics, so that we have some oversight like the medical industry or the legal industry or the paragliding industry in terms of, and I don't necessarily think that that needs to be a government body. I'm not, and I'm going to speak as Nikki Tudge now, not as PPG, because sometimes it has to be different. I'm not a big believer that we should be licensed as an industry by local government, because in all the research I've done, and it's been extensive, and at some point I'll write a paper on this. I have piles of research papers. Licensing, when it's implemented, tends to close the door on anybody new joining the industry. It tends to cramp creativity and advancement and tends to generate income for local governments that they don't want to let go of. And it also grandfathers in everybody in the industry. So I'm not convinced that we need to be licensing our industry because it would be done in 5,500 different ways. And that's not what I want. I want something that is a standard procedure. I think it needs to be done through a self-governed industry credentialing body that manages input to the training process in terms of approach, methodology, philosophy, allows for professional autonomy because, you know, doctors have professional autonomy, lawyers have professional autonomy, but there are guidelines. A doctor can't go and do an appendicitis operation by going in through the throat. There's certain protocols that they follow because that's the most efficient and effective way to do to remove an appendix. So professional guidelines that allow for autonomy, but that hold our industry accountable for what we're doing and that do that to the benefit of animals and not to their detriment, whether that's physically or emotionally. That is what I would like to see. And a sort of general consensus and agreement to approaches that are deemed ethical and approaches that are not, tools that are deemed ethical and tools that are not. That's I would consider my job done if we had that in place. I would feel Nikki, very good at, yeah.
Nikki Tudge's job would be done, and as PPG is an extension of Nikki Tudge.
Yeah, I could leave this world feeling really good about my time on this planet.
You could close your daily planner.
Yeah,
close your
one last time. Planner. Yeah, feeling really good. Yeah.
And exciting that we've got all of this stuff stored now. The podcast show's nearly been going for 3 years and we've been asking this question for that length of time. So we're nearly at a point where we can go back and start to see how far we've come, and I look forward to coming back to this episode when the time is right and seeing how we're getting along.
Yeah, maybe in 20 years you'll look back and say, well, she's not here now, but job was done.
Definitely. I very much, very much look forward to that day. I hope you're still with us on that day.
I hope so too.
that came out really badly. Hey, thank you so much for sharing everything today, Nikki, not just for connecting with us for this hour and a bit for the podcast recording, but connecting with me last week or whenever it was that we connected, shooting emails back and forth for how long we've been connected now, a couple of months to get to this recording. And taking all the time and energy to do all of the things that are required to get this episode recorded and out there to the masses. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And we, of course, really appreciate all of you out there tuning in today as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on these conversations about working with our animals, our people, our clients, in the most positive, funnish, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as a Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There is something there for absolutely everyone. We're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. So long, and thanks for all the fish. You'll be hearing from us again soon. Farewell.